equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, I'm Carl Ettenayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy. At the end of the age of oil, we're going to be emphasizing the energy part of it. Today, got a great show coming up. Vermont Yankee is not the only Entergy nuclear power plant to have problems. Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, based down in Maryland, are on their way here right now to testify before the legislature about the problems that other Entergy plants have had around the nation and also about disposal of the fuel. So, you know, we've heard a lot about what's been going on in Vernon with the Yankee here, with the most recent items, a leak of the treated water. But we'll put that in a little bit of context with today's discussion, and you'll get a preview of what the legislature is going to hear on Wednesday. Before that, cordwood. It's a renewable Vermont-made heating resource. A lot of people take it for granted. What do the professionals know about burning wood that they would like most people to know? We'll hear from a firewood seller, a former regulator, and a chimney sweep. First, a little bit of old business. Last week, we talked in passing about rules for feeding food waste to pigs in Vermont. I was saying some things that I had heard from people who I thought knew what they were talking about, but I hadn't confirmed them with the Agency of Agriculture. So earlier today, I spoke with the Agency of Agriculture spokesperson, Kelly Loftus, about what they allow farmers to feed to pigs. And she told me that if the farmer is going to eat the pig themselves, they can feed anything they want to them. There are no rules about that. But for any pork that they're going to sell to the public, the agency does not permit the farmers to feed unboiled garbage. That's what the regulations say. So what about food waste? Is that considered garbage? Does that need to be boiled before given to pigs, like produce that was about to be sold to humans from a farmer's market or from a supermarket or maybe perfectly good stuff? This produce that got past its date or perfectly good stuff from the farmer's market that just wasn't sold that day. She wasn't sure whether that would be called garbage under the regulations, and she was going to get back to me or have their meat inspector, Randy Quinville, get back to me. Sorry not to have the full story for you. It's not her fault. It's mine for not calling her last week, but appreciate talking with her today about it, and I'll update you next week with the full story on what farmers are allowed to feed pigs. She also said that I asked her about this system where the pigs are quasi-owned by the farmer, quasi-owned by somebody else to permit on-farm slaughter. So you go in the beginning of the season and say, here's my share for ownership of half of that pig. I'd like you to slaughter it for me on the farm when it gets to be big and strong and tasty. Is that the farmer's pig or is that meat that's sold to the public? She said she realizes that in the real world, people don't always follow this, but from the agency's perspective, it is meat sold to the public, and so the agency does not permit the farmers to feed unboiled garbage to the pigs. So that's most of the story. We'll get the rest of the story to you next week. Now on to wood burning, cordwood. It seems so mundane. It grows on trees. All you got to do is cut the wood, haul it home, bucket, split it, stack it, and burn it. Okay, a few steps there. Or maybe you burn wood, but you buy wood that's already cut and split. Are there any tricks to burning wood? And how does burning wood stack up against propane or fuel oil? Well, what's the best time of year to buy wood? One wood seller says it's right now, and he'll give his number later on in the show. Do you like the smell of wood smoke? What about the smell of diesel emissions? How do the health effects of wood smoke compare to diesel emissions? You might be surprised. We'll hear from Harold Garabedian. He's a former head of air quality at the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. And what do chimney sweeps know about burning wood that they wish most wood burners would know? We'll be talking with Vivian Davis. She's the president and, the owner and CEO of Chimney Works and does chimney sweeping. And if you burn wood, what tricks have you found to make your life easier? If you don't burn wood, what's keeping you from doing so? We're going to start out listening to David Sparrow, a neighbor of mine in East Montpelier. David is a lifelong farmer who got into the wood business a couple years ago. He wishes people would understand a few things about how he cuts wood to length when they order wood from him. I talked with David Sparrow earlier today.
I buy from various different loggers,
Yep. And
I have it brought to my location, and I have a firewood processor, and you just put it into the processor, and it's not a lot of labor, and usually within an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the diameter of the wood, I can usually have a cord run through the processor. It's still a lot of work, but it's a lot easier than doing it the old-fashioned way of swinging them all and a chainsaw and rolling them around with your back. And yeah.
So this is both bucking it to length and splitting it.
Yes, you do have a scale inside of the processor, and when you bring the logs forward to be cut, the scale is actually, it's a chain. Anything very delicate, like a nice ruler or a scale, would probably just get smashed in a matter of no time. So the wind is blowing, the machine is rocking, so you're never exactly right to the inch like you would like to be, but you're close, and that's where it can be an issue when people call up and order wood. You know, 16 inch for 3/4 of the people out there is fine. Where it can get rather difficult is people that have a 16 inch firebox, which means they can pound a 16 inch stick in there if they want to, but they really should be ordering up 14 inch wood. And same thing with people with like a 14 inch firebox, they should be ordering up 12 inch and so on. And so I have been in trouble with people in the past ordering up wood and right to the inch and never asking just how big is the firebox on their wood stove or their furnace. And you'll liable to get a call in January where they're really upset because they had a stick that they tried to wrestle into the thing. It wouldn't quite fit. And by the time they realized it, the stick was on fire and they were running across their home with it. And there's sparks flying off the stick and they're burning holes in their carpet. And, oh, I've been called some pretty wonderful names on that one. And the other part that's an issue there is it does take far more time, and actually takes an increase in wood. I mean, a cord should be a cord should be a cord, you would think, but it actually increases the volume of wood that you have to put onto a load every time you go a 2 inches or so shorter in dimension.
It's also got to be more work for you. It's more cuts per linear feet of log that you're cutting up.
That too, absolutely.
So do you charge more for the smaller pieces of wood?
Yeah, I have, and you feel guilty about doing it. Some people understand, but in my ad in the paper, I put down specifically, you know, that prices for the shorter dimensions. And what I found people doing is they'll have a 14-inch firebox and they want 14-inch wood. And of course, you know, you got to be really careful when I'm doing this not to go over 14-inch. And sometimes I have a whoops and I know one will slip through on me, but not a lot, but it does happen. But people, I don't blame them. I'm a bargain hound. I like to save all the money I can. And so they would rather not pay the extra $20 for a wood that's cut 2 inches shorter than what their firebox is, but they'd be a whole lot happier in the long run.
So I sometimes get wood that's a little bit longer than the width or depth of my firebox, and I just put it in at an angle, and it works that way, but I can't put too many of those in at once, of course.
Some people have the great innovation fitting them into their stove on an angle, or they may have a saw and it's no problem, they cut them in half, but not everybody has that ability. I have one gentleman, he's a three-year customer, ordered up and asked for 20-inch wood. And the first year that I did it, I brought him over his third cord, and his wife and he were out in the yard with a table saw cutting it all in half. And so I looked with kind of astonishment. He come on over and said hi, and I says, did I make the wood too long? He says, no. He says, it's fine. I says, so what's this all about? And he says, well, we can't get anybody to do 12-inch wood, so we get extra long and saw it all in half.
So it's now the middle of January, late January. Do you have dry wood? What are you selling it for?
I do have dry wood. This last spring, I took the old hay barn which is about 180 feet long, and the flow is built up really rugged so we could back in Canadian trailer truck loads of hay in there that would weigh about, you know, 16 to 18 ton at a time. So it's good and rugged. Wood is very heavy. And put it on that barn floor. I figured when we were kids and we used to stack hay in that barn, and we couldn't wait to get back out in the hot sun where it was cooler to pick up another load, and it worked. It was like that wood was like in a kiln, and I did buy a moisture tester and tested it, and it all ranged, depending on the species of wood, from anywhere from 12% moisture down to 6% moisture. And so I wasn't sure just how dry that was, so I took it up and stabbed that tester into my 8-year-old workbench, and that tested 6% moisture too. So I guess you can't get much drier than 6%. This year, I'm getting $310 a cord for it. I've probably gone through about 55 cord, and there's about 5 cord left down there on the barn floor.
Are you selling greenwood as well?
Yeah, I marked it down the best I could, and had some people grab. And for $190 a cord, right now is a good time to be buying wood. I'm not in a major rush. It's probably as soon as everybody gets their pre-buy heating oil bill this spring, that's when the rush will be on. And even right now, these loggers are looking to get rid of a load wherever they can. And the great advantage to this is I can buy loads. I can be choosy about what I buy for loads. So I'm getting some pretty nice stuff of a lot of rock maple, beech, and yellow birch, and not a lot of other woods mixed in with it.
How do people get in touch with you?
Oh, I didn't realize we were going to go that far. My phone number, you can call me at 229-2347 or 229-2347, however is easier to remember that.
And just leave a message.
David Sparrow, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
David Sparrow is a farmer in East Montpelier who's diversified into firewood in the last couple of years and a neighbor of mine. You're listening to Equal Time, and I'm Carl Ettnayer, the Monday host. Next up, we're going to be talking with Harold Garabedian about the emissions from wood. First, a few facts about wood burning. How much of our heat comes from wood? The figure I've found is for the U.S. as a whole. It's a little bit old. It's for the 2004-2005 heating season. And at that time, wood provided 4.4% of the residential heating needs in the U.S. I'm guessing for Vermont, especially in the last year or two, it's going to be more, but I don't have those figures. Also, how much does wood cost to heat with compared to oil or propane? Well, every month, the Department of Public Service puts together the Vermont Fuel Price Report, and their December report is the most recent one. They said greenwood at $190 a cord, the same price we heard David Sparrow quote, it costs 40% less than heating oil for the same amount of heat to the home. And if you're comparing it with propane, wood costs almost 60% less. And I assume, I don't know this, but I assume that the calculations are based on buying the wood at the green price and then drying it at your place while it's stacked and then burning it when it's dry, because obviously you get a lot more heat out of it when you wait until it's dry. Harold Garabedian is in Montpelier. He's a former director of the Air Quality Division at Vermont's Department of Environmental Conservation. That's a division of the ANR, the Agency of Natural Resources. Harold, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So firewood, it's a Vermont-based research. It gives off a resource. It gives off lovely flames, nice smell of wood smoke. What's it do to the air?
Well, you're right. I mean, I think wood is sort of the good news, bad news story about wood and the way we use it. I mean, wood, on one hand, is a local renewable resource, which are its good qualities. However, depending on the technology, the quality of the fuel, and the way the burning appliance is operated, it can end up in creating a lot of smoke, a lot of air pollution. Burning biomass lets off a lot of chemicals similar to those that we find in cigarette smoke, a lot of chemicals that are known as suspected human carcinogens, things like benzene, formaldehyde, even dioxin can be emitted from wood burning.
So how does that compare with diesel emissions, for example?
Well, you know, in some ways, there's a lot of you find a lot of comparable types of things in terms of diesels and wood smoke. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the odor is different, and I think that's principally driven by the fact there's no sulfur in wood and there's sulfur in oil. And that's what, you know, gives that sulfur a little more acrid smell. And wood, wood can get that acrid smell under the right conditions as well. You know, like this morning, I don't know if people noticed, but this morning wood smoke was pretty thick because we had a temperature inversion with the warm air over the cold ground. Hold that smoke down, and I suspect we saw elevated levels of wood smoke throughout the state today.
You're speaking from the perspective of the valley of Montpelier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure that's where wood smoke will trap in the valleys, because we'll get, particularly, like I said, conditions when you get warm air over cold ground.
Right.
The other thing is the particles, but you know, particles of wood smoke are very small, and those particles will penetrate deep into the lung. And they're actually so small they'll even pass through the wall of the lung and into the bloodstream. And once something does that, then it can affect any organ in the body.
So real Vermonters have wood smoke in their blood.
So it's one way to think of it.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the bad news part of it. And I think we need to recognize that in the fact that, you know, a wood stove probably puts out 200 times more emissions than a good oil furnace, or probably about 8,000 times more emissions than a gas furnace. So, I mean, I think those are facts, those are numbers, and we have to deal with them.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about emissions, you're talking about these particulates, for example, and what about carbon dioxide in oil versus wood?
Well, I think that the issue of carbon dioxide in oil versus wood is a little bit different in that you're burning contemporary carbon. So both oil and wood emit carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. However, the argument about wood is that it's going to be taken up by that regrowth. And while a portion of that's true, you also have a lot of other emissions along the way. You've got the emissions of the harvesting process. You've got the emissions of the delivery process. You've got the emissions of processing. You know, so it's not totally neutral, but certainly in a directional way, from a carbon dioxide point of view, burning contemporary carbon is better than burning fossil carbon.
So
it's not a free ride, but it's a better direction.
For a certain amount of heat, a million BTUs of heat from wood, what percentage would you guess in the Vermont harvesting and transporting processing system is accounted for, or is offset, I guess, by gasoline, diesel emissions in the harvesting, the processing, the transport?
I don't have a number for you.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the three things about wood burning and emissions that really ought to be thought about is the technology. I think what's the device you're burning it in, that's important. What's the fuel? What's the fuel quality? That's important. And how is the stove operated? That's important. And I think relating back to your conversation with David Sparrow, you heard some of that stuff in terms of the wood needs to be conditioned properly, and green wood is 50% moisture, and that means you're putting 20 pounds of green wood into a stove to burn. You're putting 10 pounds of biomass and 10 pounds of water.
Nice.
In there, and so you got to burn that water, if you will, and that really contributes to forming these chemical emissions.
Right.
So conditioning the wood is very important, and you know, again, it could be done as David explained, where he's actually got a processor to do it, and there are other folks around the state that do process wood in somewhat similar outcomes.
Well, his processor, just to be clear on that, that's for bucking and splitting the wood.
Well, he also was storing it in a large barn
that
got really warm, and that drove off the moisture in the summer.
That's right.
Yeah, and that, you know, getting down to that under 10% moisture is very good.
Mm-hmm. What about new versus old stoves? According to the Vermont Comprehensive Energy Plan, at least the draft that was available for public comment last year, the new EPA-certified stoves put out about a third as much emissions as the older ones.
You're correct. Certified, you know, we've had national emission standards for wood stoves for nearly 20 years now, and that's sort of good news and the bad news. I mean, having the standards has made stoves get an increment of better. However, a 20-year-old standard is a 20-year-old standard, and it's really not good enough anymore. And in fact, EPA has it under review and probably will be coming out with a revised standard later this year. There's a lot of technology that can improve the burning in residential appliances. And one of the benefits is as you clean up emissions in wood stoves, you actually make them more efficient. We saw this in the outdoor water boilers. You know, a lot of people bought those outdoor water boilers, and they were just horrendous pollution problems. One of those boilers probably equals, you know, over 20, maybe even 30 wood stoves.
The old ones.
The old ones, which are really all the ones out there because the new ones really haven't come out yet.
Hmm.
And those things are probably only 30, 40, even the best of them were maybe 50% efficient.
Wow.
So that means, you know, you are wasting half your wood, over half your wood.
Well, Harold Garabedian, you're not in state government anymore.
That's correct.
So I think you can you'll probably feel free to answer this. I hope any particular types of wood stoves that you would recommend for clean emissions, brand name or otherwise.
Well, I think there are a lot of good stoves, and I think people have to find a stove that fits their needs. And I think sizing a stove properly is very important. Size one to your need, because what you want to do is not have that stove run hot, run cold, run hot, run cold. You want to run that stove relatively even for best performance, both in terms of emissions and efficiency. So I think you need, you know, point one is size it for your need and in your application. I think point two is in my opinion, catalyst stoves result in less emissions, cleaner stacks, less chimney sweeps, less chance of chimney fires than non-catalytic equipped stoves.
Really?
However, when you buy a catalyst stove, you do pick up an additional item in that not only does a stove require maintenance, any stove requires annual inspection and maintenance. Make sure the seals are good and tight and functioning properly. If you have a cat, you need to inspect that cat annually. And that cat will probably need to be replaced every 5+ years.
Right.
But from an efficiency maintenance point of view of stack cleanliness, the catalyst stoves, in my opinion, are better than the non-catalyst stoves.
Okay. Well, stay on the line for a minute, Harold. We've got a caller who may want to ask you a question. We're going to Moortown to talk to Henry. Hello, Henry.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Well, I've got some comments and questions about the new wood pellet burning stoves. Is that too much off topic?
Go ahead.
Well, I bought one. This is my first year, and it's rated for about 80,000 BTUs, and I'm finding that it's not putting out the amount of heat that I would expect it to put out. I've gone through almost a ton of pellets so far, and it's great as far as, you know, there's not even any ash. I haven't had to empty the ashtray at all, and it burns fine. However, it just does not seem to put the output of 80,000 or even next to that out. And I'm wondering if there's any tricks, tips, or how-tos that anybody may have on getting those stoves to burn hotter. I mean, you have a settings that you can set the heat on, and even on the higher settings, it's just nowhere the heat output of a conventional stove.
Harold Garabedian, any insights on how to make a pellet stove burn hotter?
No, not really. I mean, only to say that, you know, whether it be a pellet stove or a wood stove, stoves and chimneys are systems, and they have to match. And I guess my advice would be to go back to probably manufacturer and work with them to understand if it's operating as designed or not.
Okay.
So. Well, I've had it professionally installed, and it's just vented outside, so it's not a big chimney system. And it's got an air intake that's also vented outside. So it's set up properly. And I talked to the manufacturer, who really hasn't been much help at all, because being out of state and myself being here, they don't have any local support person that can come over.
Henry, we're going to talk to a chimney sweep next, and I'll ask her your question.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
The general public might have possible comments. Please call in. I'll be listening.
Okay, thanks for your call, Henry. And Harold Garabedian, the former director of the former director of the Air Quality Division at the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, now we're going to be talking with Vivian Davis. She is the CEO and owner of Chimney Works. Hello, Vivian.
Hello.
good to have you on the show today. Do you have any help for Henry and his pellet stove that's not getting up as to the temperature he'd like?
No, not really. It's not without seeing the system.
Right.
For one thing, a lot has to do, of course, with the end user. There's just a lot of elements, like what's the airflow in the house, the air currents in the house, how does the heat travel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't really offer too much more.
Okay.
Without the system.
Okay. Well, fair enough. I called you up because I wanted to get input from somebody who's going out and looking at people's chimneys, looking at people's stoves and the setups, and find out what you would like people to know about burning wood.
Burning wood, well, of course, as a chimney sweep company, we are seeing how people burn, what their burning habits are based on what we find when we come to do the annual inspection.
You're sort of like the dentist looking into people's mouth to see how much sugar they've been eating in the last year.
That's right. Mm. So depending on what we find, we like to see clean stacks, light all the way through, absence of debris, creosote, glazed, flaky, cracks in the chimney. In the firebox, not big chunks, just complete combustion.
Wait a minute. What did you say about cracks in the chimney? You don't want to see those, I assume.
No, we don't.
Right, okay.
That could be indication of a chimney fire.
A chimney fire that people maybe didn't notice?
Right. Not all chimney fires can be detected, or you don't even know that they happened. Sometimes there's the obvious ones where the flames are shooting out the top, and you hear the rumble like a train coming through your house. But some chimney fires are go unnoticed.
Okay, so you want to see a clean chimney. When you see a clean chimney in a once a year inspection, will you clean it anyway?
We would run a brush through to get rid of anything that may have accumulated along the sides of the chimney or the interior.
Mm-hmm.
We also check all the accessible areas when we come out to do a sweep, as far as the interior and exterior of the chimney.
Okay. I notice a lot of people don't have their chimneys go very high above the peak of the house. What are your thoughts on that?
That can affect the draft.
Mm-hmm.
There's a formula based on where your chimney is placed on your roof or as to how high it should be.
Do you make recommendations to clients you visit about changing that?
If necessary, if someone complains about backdrafting, smoke coming, entering the living spaces when they go to load wood, or just when they're burning, they start to smell smoke in the house. Mm. And that can be oftentimes a draft problem because their chimney isn't tall enough. And then there's other things because of the area that we live in. It's unique. You can have downdrafting problems if you live in a valley and the sun goes down and the currents of the wind change, and it just pushes the air down, like if you live lower than a mountain sometimes, which most of us do. So
right. So the daytime currents are the air going up the slope, and when it shifts at sunset to air going down the slope, that can push smoke right back down the chimney?
It can.
Wow.
The pressure changes. So I noticed, too, like when the sun comes up or the sun comes down, if you go out, you can just feel it also in the air. And that has an impact on the pressurization of your house as well, your home.
How about seasoned dry wood is something that Harold Garabedian recommended from an emissions point of view and efficiency. I assume you agree with that.
Yes, that's key to having clean burning, is to have the dry wood.
How do you make sure the wood's dry? Do you get one of those dryness testers or moisture testers in wood or what?
No, we're not that high tech, but I like to plan ahead and, we buy our wood early in the season. Like, when you stop burning for the season is, when I like to think about sweeping the chimney and buying my wood for the next season.
So you're doing that in April or May?
April or May. Mm-hmm. Thinking about wood even sooner, I think, as Harold, or was it, I'm sorry, David said, thinking about February, March.
Right.
For next year. I mean, we have to really plan ahead living here in Vermont, you know. Mm.
Any particular woods, that you, types of wood you recommend?
What's available in our area, of course, you know, we want to use the resources that are available. The ones with the highest BTUs in our area are ash and sugar maple. And then there's few other woods between it, but we don't have those up here. Then is next is paper birch and cherry.
Hmm. Anything to avoid?
Spruce is one wood I've found that burns cold. If it just the fire feels cold, I don't know how to explain it. I wouldn't want to touch it, but it just feels cold. It doesn't heat the space.
Okay, so if your electricity goes out and your refrigerator is not running, burn spruce?
Right. No.
No. Not that cold.
Right.
Okay, speaking of electricity, do you have electricity back at your place now?
No, we don't.
Okay.
The wind has knocked out our electricity, so we're running on a generator and keeping the home warm with the fires. So. Well,
appreciate your starting up the generator to talk to us on the phone.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Vivian, we have the people we were going to have on the second half of the show talking about burning atoms for Vermont Yankee. Do we have somebody on there already? Okay, we've got somebody on for that second segment. So I think I'll just ask you to wind it up, Vivian. Is there anything else that you'd like us to know about burning wood, how to do it, what to do, and so on?
I think a good resource for the listeners is there's a website. It's out there from the Chimney Safety Institute of America, and their website address is www.csia.org, and there's all kinds of helpful tips there about burning wood and maintenance of your chimney system and your fireplace or heating, much more than we can cover in this short time.
Okay.
Also, we have a website that has a lot of information if listeners would like to go there, and that's chimneyworks.org.
Chimneyworks.org or CSIA. .org. I'll put both of these links on the Equal Time Radio website later on today. That's equaltime.com. Sorry, equaltimeradio.com. Got to get my own one right. Vivian Davis, the owner and CEO of Chimney Works, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Carl Ettenier, the Monday host of Equal Time Radio, and our guests for the second half of the show from Beyond Nuclear down in Maryland were turned back to Maryland on their way to JFK, where they were going to call us. They're going to be testifying in the legislature on Wednesday about Entergy's practices around the country, not just in Vermont. We don't have them available because they are in flight, but we have somebody else to talk about something similar. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Equal Time Radio. I'm Carl Ettenier, your Monday host. My theme is food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Today we're emphasizing the energy side of it. We're hoping to bring to you a sneak preview of a talk that will be given to the legislature on Wednesday, so in that case it'll be testimony, I guess, but also in Montpelier Tuesday night, in Norwich on Thursday evening, by three speakers. We're going to have two of them on the phone, Kevin Camps and Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, which is sort of a regulatory watchdog over the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry. They got turned around in this storm. They were on their way to JFK Airport in New York from Maryland, and they're on their way back down to Maryland right now. So instead, we have one of the organizers of their visit, Deborah Stolaroff, who's on the phone with us. Deborah, welcome to Equal Time.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us on short notice.
No problem.
So why don't you tell us about what your organization is and these talks on the hidden and not-so-hidden costs of Entergy's Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant?
Sure. So I am a member of the Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance, and we decided to hold a series of talks over the next few months while the legislative season. And the first talk that we decided to hold, and just coincidentally, was about the fuel cycle nuclear power, the nuclear fuel cycle. And so we invited Lorraine Reckmans from the Serpent River First Nation community in Elliott Lake, Ontario, and that is a community which has been mined for uranium and has had many disastrous health and environmental effects as a result. And then we also invited Kevin Camps and Paul Gunter, who are both, I would say, experts in the field of Kevin in particular in high-level nuclear waste, and Paul is an expert in many issues in terms of nuclear power. And they will be speaking tomorrow night, Tuesday, at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Church in Montpelier. We will have a potluck beforehand if people want to join us for that. They're free to join us for that. And they'll speak about issues that, and you know, the whole nuclear fuel cycle, but in particular, Paul and Kevin are prepared to talk to us about the current issue of tritium and the underground piping at Vermont Yankee. As well, they will speak about the radioactive isotopes that have also been found in the water of a storage, I guess it's a storage tank, and that's cobalt 60, I think it is, and I'm trying to remember what the other isotope
zinc 65
was. 65, thanks. They'll be speaking to those issues and giving us more information. I'm not anywhere near being an expert or having lots of information, though when you called to tell me that they weren't going to be able to join you, I did pull up a bunch of different emails that I've been getting and some information just in case. I should say that the public is welcome to listen to their testimony. It will be Lorraine Reckmans and Kevin Camps will testify at the State House on Wednesday, the 27th, from 10 a.m. till noon, and that will be in room 11. They will be testifying to a joint House and Senate Natural Resources Committees.
Okay, and the email that I got earlier today, it says room 10 in the State House, but
it's been changed to room 11.
That's a bigger hearing room, so that will allow more people in the public to come in and listen. That's 10 to 12 at noon on Wednesday in Montpelier. And the potluck at the Unitarian Church begins Tuesday, tomorrow night, at 6 o'clock. And at 7 p.m., the program with the speakers, all three of the speakers, begins. And they're also speaking down in Norwich on Thursday.
Yes, that will be just Paul and Kevin. Lorraine wasn't able to stay for that. So they'll be speaking at the Norwich Library at 6 p.m. on Thursday evening.
Hmm. And who's paying for them to come in?
The Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance.
Which gets its funding from?
We get our funding from anyone who wants to donate.
Very good. And how would people
find? We're a grassroots organization, all volunteer. We do write grants for ourselves and get money from grants. We have had some very generous donations in the last few years that have allowed us to have these tours, and we've helped to fund the walk that just happened from the Safe and Green Walk, and we helped to fund the town meeting campaign that happened last year, and we do a lot of educational outreach, and we also generally organize a lot of the demonstrations that happen in front of the State House the issue of Vermont Yankee.
How would people find out more about Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance?
They could go to our website at vyda.org. It's in sore need of a little bit of an update, but it can give you some information about what we're doing.
That's vyda.org. I'll put that information plus the information about the testimony and the talks in Montpelier and Norwich on the equaltimeradio.com website right after the show. Stick around for just a minute, will you, Deborah? We've got Dean in Waitsfield who's on the phone and may want to talk to you. Hello, Dean.
Okay. Hello, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Not too much. I've called your radio station on a couple of shows like 4 times in the past week, and I just have a simple question, and nobody seems to want to answer. I was just wondering, with spent fuel rods that are on, you know, the river there, what would happen if a natural disaster took place? What would be the effects of the nuclear waste going into the river or going into the groundwater? Would just a few fish die, or would a whole bunch of people die? Would everything get polluted from here to New York City? Or I'm just wondering exactly what would happen, because the stuff is hot for a whole long time, and I'm just was wondering what would the effects be.
Dean, I wish we had our scheduled guests on the radio now instead of in an airplane turned back to through the storm to Maryland, because they could probably take a crack at that. But I'm going to make you 4 for 4, because I'm not going to touch that question. Deborah
well,
Stoloff?
How about your guests?
The one thing, I don't think that I could give you a correct answer. I could give you, based on the limited knowledge that I have, I could assume that if, in fact, a radioactive material got into the Connecticut River, we'd have a lot of devastation. It's because already the picocuries that are in the well are well above. On Beyond Nuclear, their website says that what was in the well is. I'd have to find the. I think it's well above 100 times the allowable federal level of drinking water and 70 times the standard of for groundwater. So that's a lot of picocuries.
Dean, come on over to Montpelier on Tuesday night and ask the speakers yourself, please.
Oh, I have a hard time getting up, but,
I'll try to ask them for you and report back.
Yeah, that would be good. It's just amazing to me that this stuff is hot for so long and nobody talks about what the effects would be if, God forbid we had a humongous, flood or an earthquake or somebody dropped a bomb on it.
Yep.
And everything dropped, went into the water system.
It's a good point. Thanks for the call, Dean. We're gonna have to take a quick break here, and then we'll come.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
We're gonna come right back and go right back to the phone. I'm Carl Etner. This is Equal Time Radio. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Equal Time Radio. I'm Carl Etner, your Monday host. We've got a few minutes left and a couple of callers here, so we're gonna try to fit them both in. We're gonna go to Faceton first. Judy, hello.
Hello there.
Quick question, please, or comment.
Yes, I have a couple of answers here.
Wonderful.
I'll try to make them brief. I was head of a legislative advisory committee in downstate New York. We were one of 4 counties surrounding Indian Point. And the advisory committee had heads of all the county agencies, fire, police, school, ambulance, you name it. And it had to deal with evacuation planning. And I work with a nuclear scientist on that. And the spent fuel casks, that is, of course, a major hazard. It's why, they were being trucked from Maine to Barnwell, South Carolina, where they used to store them. And that's stopped. It's closed. But they used to take them down local roads over the rocks in the Hudson River in the sharp V and go back up to the highway. And we got that changed so that they had to stay on the interstates. The final outcome of that whole thing that I dealt with was all 4 counties each got $250,000. What that would accomplish is, I don't know. But the spent fuel casks are a major could be a major problem.
Any insights into Dean's question about what would happen if the Connecticut River flooded and overflowed the fuel site storage area?
The flooding. The thing is, if they remain underwater for a long time, I mean, they have, the half-life is, I think, up to 1 million years. We wouldn't even be here if they went their natural way to disintegration. But it is a problem with potential terrorism attacks, as is the dome of the plant.
Judy, you're going to try to squeeze in this one last call. So.
No, I have two things quickly. Okay. The cobalt, the two other radioactive elements are cobalt-60 and strontium-90. Cobalt-60, and these are both have been found to be in the underground water. They say it's a radioactive poison. It's used for other things also. The strontium-90 is a highly toxic radioactive poison. Fallout from nuclear explosions, etc., when ingested, attacks bone marrow with possibly fatal results. It's used in other things also. But this is in the Condensed Chemical Dictionary. I gave the wording for that for you out of that, just so I could make it quick.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Appreciate to have your knowledge. Going to Shelburne, Ted, make it quick, please.
Yes, I think maybe the quickest and best would be to say to go on a computer to Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear, and that will, you know, that covers a lot of good information. There are plenty of other websites. Oh, also, those, if mud gets in the vents of the cask storage that's in place now, it can overheat. In other words, they've been checked for water flooding. If it's clean water, Maggie Gunderson was speaking about this morning on Mark's show.
Yeah, I was listening. Good point.
Yeah, and anyhow, go, you know, check the internet, Google some things about this issue, and you get some good basic information. Gotcha. As well as, I'm sure, your expected experts, but
so
we're missing them.
Union
right
of
now.
Concerned Scientists website you recommend, Ted. Thanks
correct.
So much for your call.
And then if you follow that with nuclear, that gets you into the zone.
Okay, very good. Thank
There's
you.
A lot to go there. Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye. So, burn wood or burn atoms? Neither one's consequence-free. I'm trying to provide you with the best information so you can make up your mind on how and whether to burn wood in your home and whether to support VY for another 20 years. Thanks for the calls from Henry in Moortown, Dean in Waitsfield, Judy in Faiston, and most recently, Ted in Shelburne. I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Don't forget to check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Transition towns are working to transform society from oil dependence to community resilience in the face of peak oil, climate change, and economic collapse. They engage the heads, hands, and hearts of people from across the community to strengthen the local economy and make better use of local renewable resources. Last summer in Vermont, Transition Town Montpelier held a village building convergence that brought the transition town concept back to its roots in early permaculture. These days, permaculture is a set of design tools so broad that even its inventors shy away from trying to define it. But it originated as a form of landscape design. The design emphasizes perennial crops and ecological interactions that simplify management. The productive landscape is designed around buildings people live in. Montpelier's Village Building Convergence, or VBC I'll say so I don't have to keep repeating Village Building Convergence, was held in August last year, and it was inspired by a similar week-long gathering that's been held in Portland, Oregon for about 8 years. The 2009 event was a success, and organizers are hard at work to plan this year's event. The VBC emphasizes projects with large numbers of volunteers who learn new skills while reshaping landscapes near dwellings using perennials. Much of last year's activity was around a private house on Main Street, where the owners wanted to convert a rocky forested backyard into a terraced edible forest garden. Mark Krochik of Burlington Permaculture led the week-long conversion, recruiting volunteers who wanted to learn to clear a small woods using hand tools, turn a slope into a terrace with steps, or design a permaculture landscape
for that space. The landscape design and installation on Main Street was also a backdrop for workshops about components of the permaculture landscape. Alyssa White taught backyard gourmet mushroom gardening. Nico Rubin taught an introduction to edible landscaping and small fruits for Central Vermont. And Krawczyk himself demonstrated how to create habitat for bats. The VBC also featured projects and workshops in spaces more public than the Main Street backyard. Gail England directed a crew building an earthen oven at the Adamant Co-op outside of Montpelier. Emma Melvin conducted a citywide tour of rain gardens and an installation of a new one at the local food co-op. Adrian Allison led a medicinal plant walk starting at Montpelier's high school, and Zachary Brock headed up a bicycle tour of inspiring gardens, starting with a food garden planted on the Vermont State House lawn. While the focus was on Montpelier, some events were scattered in, well, the hinterlands, as they're called in transition speak, the outlying towns of Plainfield, Marshfield, Worcester, and Callis. Though classical permaculture elements dominated the VBC, there was more. I gave a talk about bicycles and motorcycles as practical transportation, and a workshop on nonviolent communication taught how to listen and speak so as to connect with what's alive in other people. And there were simply parties at the opening and the night before the closing. The transition work involves many elements, like launching local currencies, organizing energy co-ops, and planning emergency response in a time of prolonged fuel or electricity shortages. And sometimes it's important, and just plain fun, to gather in community, roll up your sleeves, and build a new rain garden or earthen oven. That's what the Village Building Convergence is all about. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.